Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's spooky season in Charlotte. Ghosts, goblins, and skeletons adorn houses across the city, and this weekend some of them will take to the streets as Halloween is upon us. Well, today, we thought it would be a welcome break from the news to revisit some of our more ghoulish shows from over the years to help you get into the spirit. Spirit, get it? Later in the program, we'll hear from Aaron Menke, host of the hit podcast Lore, that reveals dark tales from history. But first, ghost stories from Charlotte and North Carolina's sordid past. In 2006, we spoke with local storytellers, two Charlotte natives, who know where the bodies are buried and which houses are haunted. Stephanie Burt Williams is a third-generation native Charlottean and the author of Wicked Charlotte, the Sordid Side of the Queen City, and of Ghost Stories of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County, Remnants of the Past in a New South. Ron Gulledge is a storyteller, also a Charlotte native, who has been telling stories professionally for over a decade in museums, schools, and festivals across the Carolinas. I started by asking them why they have an interest in ghost stories.
Well, I do have a personal interest in ghost stories, and that's really what drove me to write the book in the first place, because I grew up reading Nancy Ryan, Nancy Roberts, and just loved all the folklore, all the stories, and always wanted to know, have I been there? Was I going to go there? You know, a lot of them were about the coast, but there was never anything about Charlotte. So when I became old enough to write about it, I decided that I would fill in that gap.
And how did you know there would be stories to find?
There's history here.
Where?
We knocked down a lot of it, but you just have to look around the corner. There's actually a lot of history here. Mainly under the sidewalks and the new shiny buildings, mm-hmm. but people have been living here for a long time. So,
and dying here.
Yes, exactly.
And therefore ghosts.
And therefore ghosts.
Exactly.
And not always happily.
Well, we'll talk about that as we go through the program. Was there anything in your background that prepared you to write ghost books, aside from the fact that you kind of like ghost stories and history?
I think my father prepared me to write it. He wouldn't like to say that he did, but my father is an insane history buff and got me really interested in history, and he loves military history. I never really got into that as much, so I got into more of the folklore history, and that really prepared me to be ready to write ghost stories. Because I liked the everyday stories that weren't on the battle. And you get little snippets of history when you're in ghost stories. You learn about the history of the house, the person who lived there before you, or who was, you know, died in the house, or, you know, is buried there. So you get these little snippets of everyday history. And that's what I really liked more than the military movements and battles.
She's right. There's so much history here. And, you know, let's face it, there's not a lot of it visibly, but talk mm-hmm. to folks and folks who have been here, and there's plenty. Mm-hmm. You know, this area was settled by Native Americans many, many years ago, and, you know, the English were here in the 1740s, so there's plenty.
Mm-hmm. You say, Stephanie, that ghost stories, that's hard to say, ghost stories are the best secrets, and that ghost stories are the closest we can come to actually experiencing the past. How so?
Because ghost stories really are, in a very kind of kitschy way, a time travel thing, because you've got the past meeting the present. It's a really concrete way for us today to really connect with the people that were in the past, because we could actually maybe hear their disembodied voices, or we could perhaps see their shadow, you know, move across the sidewalk. So there's really a connection there. And if you tell a ghost story well, you really do put yourself in that time.
You have also visited some of these places that you write about.
Yes.
And I know that you've had, because you've written about it, at least one experience in one of these locations.
Yes.
Do you think that's because you were there investigating the potential of ghosts and spirits, and so your mind was predisposed to experience this?
I really don't, because if that were the case, I have a really good imagination. I would have had a lot more experiences researching this book than I actually had. And plus, it was Saturday morning, it was May, it was sunny, it was pretty. I really was thinking I'm going to do this interview and spend the rest of my weekend. I really wasn't thinking, ooh, I'm going into a haunted house.
Yeah.
And that's when it happened.
And now you live in Charleston, and Charleston is a place that is known for history and known for ghosts.
Yes.
I mean, I was eating, and this is a true story, I was eating, and I forgot what street it was from. There's a restaurant in Charleston. I was sitting in there, and this is many years ago, and I heard an opera singer singing. And they weren't particularly good, but I didn't hear any music. I just heard the voice.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked the waiter where that was coming from, because it got progressively louder. And he said, that's our ghost. Oh, come on. No, he said, that's our ghost. He or she, I forget whether it was a woman or man's voice, sings opera on occasion.
Wow.
So
our ghost.
Yeah, well, it's second floor. He said the second floor is haunted. We don't go up there.
That's the thing about ghosts, though, that they really, I mean, I think that's what's so surprising about them is they happen, you know, ghost stories happen on a daily basis. I mean, it's not usually when you're going out to the graveyard at midnight with all kinds of spooky ideas that you actually see a ghost. It's when you're eating at a restaurant or when you're just getting ready for bed and brushing your teeth that you hear something walk down the hall. That's what makes it scary.
We live in an electronic age. What is the power of sitting in a room with a bunch of kids, or a bunch of adults for that matter, and simply telling a story?
Mike, it's the connection. A good teller, if you'll stand and observe, and many times that's the best part of watching the audience and how they respond and react to that teller. And if they're good, you can actually almost watch the audience deeply connect with the teller, and they are thinking in their own minds of occasions in the past that occurred to them as that teller is speaking. So it's connection. And, you know, the frivolous ways that we find ways to entertain ourselves, and I'm not going to get up on my soapbox with it too much other than to say that folks are looking for real and true connective outlets. Television is not that. Video games is not that. If not, storytelling would have died out with the advent of television and movies.
TV is kind of a narcotic, and it also doesn't require very much of you except to sit and look. And when you're listening to a storyteller, it seems to me, or reading a book, you are supplying all the details with your imagination. You're really engaged.
Thus even the power of radio.
Exactly.
Thus even that, because, again, there is all of... When you're listening to someone on the radio, you're filling in, you're using your minds. I really believe it's that. Again, if it wasn't powerful and it wasn't those things, television, movies would have taken over and storytelling would have died out.
We have a few minutes for a ghost story. I don't know which one you want to tell. I know that you have a story about mining here in Charlotte, and you have another story about Edisto Island, which is near where Stephanie lives now. Which one would you like to tell?
Mike, the one down at Edisto struck our family the closest. It's a story that occurred to us. We actually picked it up initially through one of Nancy Ryan's books, then initially visited the site. So I'll tell you that one briefly. It's a story of Julia Legree. The oldest standing Presbyterian church in South Carolina is at Edisto Island. And I have a hobby. When I'm traveling, I like to do grave rubbings. And, of course, with permission.
Rubbings, not
rubbings.
Rubbings. Okay.
Rubbings, where I'll actually take, R-U-B-B, where I'll actually take some paper, artist paper, and with permission go out and do rubbings. And I knew this particular cemetery had some very old, some very prominent families from South Carolina that built their homes up on Edisto. The folks living then would get swamp fever. And they didn't realize that it was malaria driven by mosquitoes, and so they built their summer homes out on Edisto, these big big plantations. So we stopped at Edisto, and I asked the groundskeeper if I could have permission to go out and do some rubbings, and he said that I could. And I noticed out back very quickly there was a tomb or a crypt without a door, and thought that was pretty interesting. So I walked to the back of the cemetery and walked in and looked around, and I saw a name on the tombstone that was planted in the wall of the crypt. Her name was Julia Legree. I asked the groundskeeper standing out front, who we had met and got permission from, the story and what was going on, and he said during the Civil War, when there was a great muster, a great call for soldiers, that all of the young men on the island answered, and they marched off to fight, thinking, of course, that the South would win in 6 months, and little did they know, and, you know, short order in 4 years, they were back. But Matthew answered that call and very quickly went off to fight at the First Battle of Bull Run, or Manassas, and lost his arm. And when he was sent home, the only job that he could find and where they would take him was at the church, and he was a groundskeeper. He took care of the property. He didn't realize, too, that he'd be in charge of the burials with the soldiers that were being sent back. And, of course, during this time, with no doctors and no one there to take care of people, they all were off fighting, folks would contract diphtheria, which would cause you to fall into a coma initially, then die. Well, folks knew that it was contagious, but they didn't realize just what they needed to do, other than if you slipped into the coma, they would bury you very quickly because they didn't want to, you know, catch the disease. Well, one of Matthew's jobs was to work the graveyard shift, which meant he would have to stand out by your grave in the evenings, and there would be a string tied to your finger that would come out and be attached to a little bell there by your grave. And if you happened to wake up, he would be there to dig you up. Or the term dead ringer comes from that, too. Well, of course, as the story proceeds, he met a young lady, Julia Legree. She contracted diphtheria, and she was buried in the family crypt at a family tomb. And it was his job to wait and stay outside of her crypt to make sure that
she didn't ring the bell.
She didn't ring the bell. Well, a storm approached, and he was very, let's say, post-traumatic shock from battle and was unable to stand at his post. The lightning and the thunder from the thunderstorm drove him away, and he left, came back and assumed that everything was okay, and 2 weeks later there was another burial there that he was in charge of, and as the family was leaving and they proceeded past Julia's crypt, the door fell off, and guess who they found, who had climbed out of her casket and was there at the door where she had been before she had died, clawing and scratching and pawing at the door. Now, the part of this that's really strange that we discovered was the session, the diaconate at that church has tried to keep a door on that crypt ever since, and they would post the deacons and session members out into the woods to see if it was pranksters or someone, you know. They've never been able to do it, and so they just admitted, hey, that it was something other than they could contend with, and so the door is off.
So the door keeps coming off.
The door keeps coming off, and at this point now the door, it's a big, heavy slab marble that they would chain and do everything in the world they could keep it upright, and they couldn't. And the fun, I told this story a year or two ago at a retirement community, and I had a family member, one of the Legrees, who was in the family.
Mm-hmm.
Come up and talk to me about that, and said that she had always heard that story and it struck a note with her, obviously.
Yeah, obviously.
So that's one that if you tell it properly and right and give it the 20 minutes can be pretty good. That's short version.
It makes you wonder if she is continually able to push the door off now, why she couldn't do it in life.
Exactly. Hey, but you're not supposed to bring that up.
But that's a story that's connected with death, and there's several elements in that story that people really get the creeps about, because they did used to mistakenly bury people alive, and
right.
They did have little strings tied around people's fingers,
right,
to ring bells to warn them that, oh my God, the person in the coffin underground is alive, let's get him out of there.
Get him out of there.
That really creeps people out, doesn't it?
You pause and you just get them thinking on their own. They're in that casket, that crypt, and they wake up. And one of the most effective, I go back to Alfred Hitchcock and some of those shows, the one that still strikes me is the one where someone was buried alive and they woke up. And of course Matthew's job was to be there, you know, to take that part. And he failed, and thus he lives with that. But that's the connection in the story. What would it be like?
That's Ron Gullidge, a local storyteller, along with Stephanie Burt Williams, author of Ghost Stories of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County. We're revisiting some spooky tales ahead of Halloween this weekend. Our conversation originally aired in 2006, and we'll have more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're getting into Halloween spirit today, revisiting a few spooktacular shows from over the years.
We're talking ghost stories, and here in Charlotte, we have more than a few local haunts with tales to tell. Our guests are two native Charlottean storyteller Ron Gullidge and Stephanie Burt Williams, the author of Ghost Stories of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County. Our conversation originally aired in 2006, and I told Stephanie that I happened to know one of the stories in her book. We'll pick it up there.
You have stories in this book about a lot of places that people will know around town. I mentioned one of them a second ago, the Manor Theater. We told the story about the old employee who kind of haunts the place. And I was reading through your book, and I nearly fell out of my chair. It was like seeing an apparition. There was a photograph of a house that I know because a friend of mine lives in it. And I read the story, and you quote John Cosby in the book about this incident that occurred at his home in Fourth Ward. How did you run across this story?
Oh, there are great resources in historic home tours. Mm-hmm. So I did the Christmas home tour in Fourth Ward. Uh-huh. And when I was there, I started, you know, asking around to the side, are there any ghosts here? And they answered my question.
Yeah, and I got John Cosby on the phone here. I pulled him out of his very busy day and got him on the phone here. John, welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. Now, in this book, and you've told me this story, I believe, because I knew it when I read it. There's a story about walking down the stairs with little puddles of water on the stairs.
They were like wet footprints. I had just gotten up, and we'd only lived in the house maybe 2 months, and we did a lot of work to it before we moved in, so there was a lot of activity. And came down the stairs, and I said, has anybody taken a shower this morning and gone to look for a towel?
Now, you had other problems with the water turning on as well, right?
Yeah, we had the water coming on in the upstairs bathroom at 3 o'clock in the morning, and there were lots of activity in the house, but it's all stuff that can sort of be explained. When we were closing, the lady that owned the house before says, oh, by the way, mischievous spirit in the house. Said, what do you mean, a mischievous spirit? Well, he's not harmless. Oh, okay.
Was that after the money changed hands?
That was after the money, yeah.
Oh, by the way.
Are you still having some activity?
We've had quite a few things happen. Once, I think I saw whoever it was. I was in the kitchen, and out of my peripheral vision, I saw something in the den. It looked like somebody in a raincoat with sort of a 1930s hat on. And I called out, and there was nothing there. And so I went and checked all the doors, thinking, you know, somebody had come in, and they were all locked. And I walked back in the kitchen, and I said, okay, who are you? And at that time, a pot fell off the pot rack.
Oh, that was fun.
So then there was nothing for a long time after that. So and we've had some work done on the house recently, and it kind of, I guess whenever you change things, it stirs up activity or something. Mm-hmm. Because I had a guest come over and had a headache and asked for some ibuprofen. I said, oh, yeah, I took some this morning. I know exactly where it is. So I went upstairs to the drawer in the bathroom where I keep it, and it wasn't there. I said, okay, I'll probably put it somewhere. So I looked every possible place that I thought I might have put it and did this 3 times. So I checked that drawer, checked this place, checked that place, went back, did the same activity 3 times. And finally, I was a little bit frustrated because I knew I had taken it that morning. I said, okay, where is it? And I opened the drawer, and there it was.
Well, there you go.
Can I give a little background of who you think the ghost is?
Sure.
Okay. Supposedly, he's the ghost of a bootlegger that used to live in your house. And he used to sell alcohol in his front hall. People would often walk onto the porch to visit for a spell, so he must have seemed really popular to his neighbors. But if the visitors were not buyers, he kept the liquor hidden from sight behind a secret trapdoor under the stairs in the front hall.
Which is still there.
Do you ever have any activity around that?
It does seem to occur in the foyer, because when we first moved in, the cat would puff up and stare at the corner in the foyer like something was really bugging her. And we had guests over one night, and it was our next-door neighbors, and she was standing in the foyer. He was standing in the dining room. We were having separate conversations, and all of a sudden, they both stopped at once and looked at each other and said, did you feel that? And we did feel the temperature drop, but they felt something brush by them at the same time.
John, thank you for joining us and sharing that story. I'd be moving.
Doesn't bother me at all.
thank you so much.
Famous,
oh, you're welcome. Anytime.
Famous last words. Thank you, John. One of the places that appears in your book, Wicked Charlotte, and one of the stories that you tell, Ron, has to do with the Reed Gold Mine.
Right.
Evidently, there must be a lot of ghosts hanging around the Reed Gold Mine because they used the shafts to dispose of a lot of people along the way.
Quite convenient.
Yeah. Tell us the story about the mad miner's wife, if you would.
Well, this is, again, tying the historical tag with it. I like to start with where was gold first discovered. And, you know, 7 out of 10 folks probably will respond, California, Great Gold Rush. But really, here in 1799, right out in Stanley County, they found gold. And Conrad Reed, young man, found I think 17 or 18 pound gold
17.
Nugget.
17. Mm-hmm.
And they used it for, because no one had ever seen gold that size, they thought, well, that'd make a great doorstop. So that's what they used it for. And his father, John Reed, made a trade trip down to Cross Creek, which is now Fayetteville, what was called Cross Creek back then. He was going to take the stone down there and try to barter with it, and he was cheated. Jeweler took advantage of him and gave him 2 or 3 pounds of green coffee beans, and he was sent back on his way. But that started the gold rush. Folks came from everywhere, not just North Carolina and South Carolina, but from Europe. A lot of families came here and said, well, hey, if there's kids finding 17-pound gold nuggets in the creeks, what can we do? But just like any get-rich scheme, for every one that finds something, the other 9 are starving to death, and that's pretty much what was happening here. And that whole area basically turned into a squatter's village, a squatter's town, and folks were coming, living in cabins or shacks or anything they could, and were panning for gold in the creek. Well, of course, they weren't planting crops. They weren't taking care of themselves for the winter. And when winter came on, a lot of them starved or just about did. One family, Ann and Jim Hutton, had moved here, and I should say Anne had stayed at home initially in England, and her husband came. And he was finding just enough dust to stay alive, just barely, and he was missing his wife, and so he wrote to her and told her to come. Well, she came from a family of means and was used to living in London in the theater and restaurants, and so he didn't fill in that part in his letter. He just said, you really ought to come. So she eventually agreed and sailed into the port of Wilmington. And, of course, Wilmington there was nice enough, and she thought, well, this is not so bad, until she loaded her bags and her trunks into a wagon and got into the outback of the Carolinas and saw really just what this was like. And
it was a frontier.
Truly a frontier, just as the only trails and roads were trading paths, virtually just like trade and trying here. So she got here and immediately wanted to go back. She hated the area, couldn't stand to be here, and her husband pleaded with her just to stay long enough. And so he would spend 8 or 9 hours a day down in the Little Meadow Creek panning for gold, and eventually found a nugget or two and brought it back. And she was on him pretty hard to leave, and that evening when he brought the nuggets back, he was going to surprise her with them, and he was going to put them on this table that he had made. And a tree had fallen, and he had sawed a section out of it and made a little table so they didn't have to just squat and eat out of their laps. And so as she was turning to serve him his food, she spilled some stew on him and burned him, and they had words, and he went out and cleaned himself up. And when he came back in, she served him another bowl. And when she turned, she was still wearing, get this, Mike, the gowns and some of the things that she had brought from England. And she stepped on the hem and fell forward and hit her head on that table and split her head from ear to ear, and bleeding very, very badly. Well, of course, he couldn't put her on the horse and get her to the doctor that evening, and so he wrapped her up as best he could and took care of her. And in the middle of the night, he heard, when are you going to take me home? And it woke him up. He was partially asleep, partially awake because the fire had died. And he realized, when feeling of his wife and what pulse she might have, that she was dead. And he was sure that he was just dreaming, that he couldn't have heard that, that he was used to hearing that so much. It was just in his mind. So he went out and was going to build the fire back up and try to illuminate the inside of the cabin so he could sort of see what was going on. And when he did, he saw that she was, in fact, dead. And then he heard her say again, when are you going to take me home? And at that point, he had a big decision to make about what to do with the body, because, in fact, the sheriff and everyone in the community knew that they were arguing and they didn't get along. And so he thought the best thing to do to solve this situation he found himself in was to dump her body down this very deep, called Engine Shaft Number 9, and he did. Well, of course, people's conscious, and when you do things, it's not like it ever goes away. You always carry that. And so he left, and he moved to northern Georgia, where they found gold, and a mint was later founded there. And he recanted the story of how she's still calling him and looking for him until this day. Well, the site manager told me that story, Mike, and I asked if I could bring my scouts. I was a scout leader, and I wanted to bring them out and let them experience that. And he looked at me, or I should say he looked right through me and said, "You're welcome to come out. You're welcome to take the tour. You're welcome to spend all day. But nobody ever, ever gets to spend the night out here for fear you'll hear Anne still calling for Jim to take him home."
Now, there's a very similar story in your book, but it features a woman by the name of Eleanor Mills. Is that correct? Is this the same woman, or is it a different story?
It's a version of the story.
Right.
It's a version of the story. It's really been retold so many times, and there's, by all accounts of the stories, it could be 8-10 bodies down there by now.
Yeah, because you have another.
And they're all women screaming.
there's the constant.
People say they found hair, they found a tooth, they found watches, but they really haven't found
bodies.
Let's
go spend the night. Come on. What do you say?
Yeah.
That's Stephanie Burt Williams, author of Ghost Stories of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County and Wicked Charlotte, the Sordid Side of the Queen City. We also spoke with local storyteller Ron Gullidge. Our conversation originally aired in 2006. Now, if you're craving even more spooky storytelling, we've got you covered. Aaron Mankey knows that truth is often stranger and scarier than fiction. His hit podcast, Lore, uncovers how horror stories and folklore full of dark figures like vampires, witches, and werewolves are actually rooted in real-life events. A little bit of history and a little bit campfire storytelling, the award-winning podcast has found quite a following. It was also made into a television series on Amazon with the help of the producers from The Walking Dead and The X-Files. WFAE's Sarah D'Elia spoke with Aaron Mankey in 2017 about the world of lore he's created and the rich tradition of folklore that has stuck around since America's early days.
Settlers up and down the East Coast of what would one day become America came ashore with heads full of superstitions and a propensity to attach meaning to things we might overlook today. They came with minds that were perfectly wired to build new folklore on the backs of old tales, new fears, new legends, new hauntings. And we can still find those creations in many places along the eastern seaboard, places like North Carolina. Before the vacation homes and sun-baked tourists crowded along the sandy shores of the Outer Banks, pioneers were attempting to carve out an existence there. Those that survived left behind more than buildings and descendants, though. Today, the Outer Bank is home to tales that still send shivers down the spines of locals and tourists alike. Because folklore, whether it's new or old, has a way of leaving its mark. I'm Aaron Mankey, and this is Lore.
You're looking into stories that are hundreds of years old. What's the research process like?
Every episode is different. Some topics are more global in nature, and so, you know, the research process is a lot more scattered and multifaceted, you know, where I'm picking up books by people who are experts in the field or, you know, journals. But then, you know, I do an episode like a recent one called Wide Open about, you know, a local incident that happened. And that one, you know, it's just more local newspaper clippings and the few books that have picked up the story and dug deep into it. It was one of those cool September nights that makes you think of campfires and dry leaves, but the man couldn't see any of that. It was the middle of the night, and he was returning from an out-of-town business trip. Ulysses Griffith sold farm equipment in the surrounding community, and it kept him very busy, even by 1903 standards. As he was passing through town, exhausted and ready to climb into bed after such a long day, he studied the small village he called home. I think we've all done this before, when we're given the chance to see our community through a new lens, while all the hustle and bustle is asleep and the lights have all flickered out. Griffith was probably reveling in it. And that's when he saw something out of the corner of his eye. It was dark out. The moon was only a quarter full, after all. But he swore he saw a shape moving on one of the nearby rooftops. He turned to look, expecting it to vanish. But no, there was something out there, climbing from building to building like an animal. An animal with a light. At least, that's what he thought. Every time it's a new adventure, it's a little bit of variety, which is nice. You know, I don't have to, it's not, there's no rut that I'm in. It's just, okay, this topic kind of means that I need to go this way with it. So I dig in. The research process typically begins with me handing the topic's name and maybe a theme that I'm guessing at and handing it to a research assistant. And I let them go out and find me all the source material and outline the, whether it's the events or a bio or whatever, they outline it out for me. And what that does for me is I've got a very distractible brain. So if I was to sit down and do all of that, I'd go down 100 rabbit trails and I would never get anything done. So I let a research assistant do it. And then they come back to me with all of those pieces. And that's where I start. I read all the sources. I read the outline. I go deep. And then once it's in my head, my brain just kind of takes over and starts putting the outline for the story together.
On the surface, your podcast is you, your voice, and some kind of creepy, well-thought-out music. But of course, there's more to it than that. There's a great amount of research that goes into it. And your writing just kind of sucks people in. You've said, I've read in other interviews, that you didn't, you know, set out to make this podcast, but it's turned out to be such a hit. Why do you think people are obsessed with this podcast?
You know, there is that deceptively simple nature of it, right? I mean, it's just, like you said, it's just me talking over a music bed. And I think because of that, maybe there's a bit less, you know, friction to get it in your head. There's no multiple talking heads you have to wrap your mind around. Who's talking now? Who is that? You know, there's no rambling discussion. It's a really focused story. I mean, it's almost like an audiobook, right? It's this pre-written historical essay that has a little bit more of a conversational tone. I'm kind of making it up as I go along, so I don't know if I've ever been able to boil down exactly what it is that makes the show so popular. That's kind of frustrating too, because if I ever had another show, I wouldn't be able to replicate it. But I also think that there's something to be said for just unanswered questions and mysteries, you know, that people like these stories because they don't pretend to have all the answers. And sometimes I think it's okay to have that. And I think some people actually seek out a little bit of mystery in their life.
More of Sarah D'Elia's interview with Aaron Menke, creator of the hit podcast Lore, in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. The Halloween spirit is with us today as we revisit some of our favorite spooky shows. Let's get back to Sarah D'Elia's 2017 conversation with Aaron Menke. He's the creator and host of the hit podcast Lore, which reveals the dark historical tales behind many of our modern-day superstitions. Lore has also been made into a television show on Amazon.
Throughout history, fear was best kept buried, sealed, closed. But folklore has a way of keeping the door open wide, allowing stories to live and breathe, to creep inside and haunt us. I'm Aaron Menke. This is Lore.
Have you always been into scary stories?
Yeah, I can trace a lot of it back to fifth grade. I don't know how much further back it goes than that. A couple of things happened in fifth grade. I was 10. My reading teacher sent us home with one of those Scholastic Readers Club catalogs, the little, you know, letter-sized newsprint, full-color things where you can buy books in. And I remember seeing a book in there. I don't remember who the author was or, you know, what it was called, but it was essentially a collection of weird but true tales, things that were supposed to have happened in the past, but were really, really on that edge of, could this have happened? You know, I convinced my parents to buy it for me and fell in love. Those stories just, it's like they flipped the switch inside my head and I've never looked back. And then It was later that year. That must have been at the beginning of the school year. And I think looking back on how it all kind of unfolded, I think maybe that catalog itself had some Halloween merchandise in it because Halloween was coming up. And then I got the book and my teacher, the same teacher, assigned us a short story for Halloween to work on our handwriting. Actually, it was a cursive assignment. She called it Chicken Scratch and wanted us to get better. So I wrote a story about a family in a pumpkin patch. And it was, it was my first attempt at writing a scary story. And I really, really enjoyed it. And I think after that, it was just a matter of every chance I had, I was writing something.
Well, most of the stories that you tell look at the worst in humanity, from people being buried alive to lobotomies and murders. How does that affect the way that you see the world? Do you see it through less than rosy colored glasses?
Yeah, it's it's kind of like talk to somebody who works at the CDC and how they view experiences at like an airport bathroom. they have a unique perspective on it, and I'm not a fully trained cultural anthropologist or a psychologist. I mean, all of this is armchair activity for me. I'm just learning as I go. But you can't read stories that are part of our folklore tradition and not walk away thinking, if this is a thing we've passed down from generation to generation, or if this is a thing that happened in the past, what does it say about us? I think you have to do that. I think that collections of tales, whether they're audio or in print or whatnot, that explore the weird things just to explore them, are missing half the picture, right? Because people tell these stories, and whether they're true or not, the story comes out of that person, and it's a reflection of who they are. Or maybe we're talking about events that happened and we see what people have done in the past, and it really does make you a little more wary of, having faith in the people around us today to make wise choices.
Yeah.
A good example is a couple of weeks ago, one of the episodes was number 70, called Familiar. It's about a man in the 1600s in England around the time of the English Civil War who kind of assigns himself the title of Witchfinder General. And he, for a year and a half, he travels all over the south of England, rounding up people suspected of witchcraft and having them executed. And he's responsible for half of the deaths connected with that in England for three centuries. And he did it all in a year and a half. I mean, he was quite prolific. And it was a job fueled by hatred of others, people they don't fit in. And it's kind of sad that that's still around today.
Well, it's easy to find a lot of different lore in New England. I know that's where you live and talking to us today from. But as we know, lore exists everywhere. And you even did a podcast episode called Making a Mark, which featured stories from North Carolina. And one of my favorite parts of that episode was the story on the Cora tree. A woman is accused of being a witch, and she mysteriously disappears from this tree that she's tied to right before she's supposed to be burned alive. This bolt of lightning hits the tree and she escapes. And the only thing left is her name carved into the tree, which people can still see on Hatteras Island today.
According to the locals who tell the tale to this day, Captain Blood approached the tree with a lit torch in his hand, ready to set fire to the wood and burn the witch and her familiar alive. But another captain, a local man named John Smith, held him back, asking instead for Cora's trial to go through the proper legal channels. Smith, you see, being a sane man, wanted to do things right. But as the men argued, two things happened. First, the child in Cora's arms twisted and writhed as it transformed into a large black cat with shimmering green eyes. Second, a dark, ominous cloud began to gather overhead in an otherwise cloudless sky. Both men cried out in horror, and then Captain Blood lunged forward with the torch to ignite the kindling. It was at that very moment that the cloud overhead rumbled, and a lightning bolt flashed down, striking the tree and blinding everyone around it. When the smoke cleared, the tree was empty. The ropes were still there, as was the pile of branches and firewood. But the woman and the cat were gone without a trace. Well, that's not true. There was one clue, but it's difficult to believe. There, etched by lightning into the bark of the old oak tree, were four clear letters, which spelled out one single word. C-O-R-A. Cora.
So my question is, when you're looking for good lores to tell, like, what's the formula? What makes one story stand out versus another one, since they're everywhere?
Yeah. I mean, I wish I had a formula because it would make it easier for me moving forward. I've done, I think 72 comes out on the 30th of this month. And you go into these, every time I go into them, I think, well, I've done a lot of these. I should be able to do this pretty easy this time. And every time is a challenge just because it's not as simple as finding a cool story. It's, does the story have room for historical context to come in and flesh things out? Does the story have a long enough drama that I can tell that particular tale for, you know, 10 or 15 minutes? And I have to hold a lot of these ideas that I get up to that lens and use my intuition to say, you know, does this fit or not? And most of the time I get the guess right. And, you know, there's been a couple times where I've started out and then I said, you know, this actually doesn't work. And I've had to walk away. But for the most part, trusting my gut, I can narrow it down. But there is no formula that I've been able to discern other than, can this tale, can it entertain? You know, and can it entertain for the amount of time I need it to?
Well, and you've done podcasting now, you've written books, and now you have a new exciting project involving the producers from The Walking Dead, where you've made a TV show of lore that's available on Amazon. Why did you want to explore that medium?
My love is story, and I'll take it anywhere I can get it. You know, I'll read graphic novels or watch TV shows or movies. Podcasts are great, and you know, picking up a book is great. I love story any way I can get it. But what I've learned over the years is that some people gravitate toward certain particular media types. And so TV watchers, there's a large percentage of them that just don't listen to podcasts or read books. And you can say the same for readers, that they're just so in love with the physical book in their hands that they don't watch a lot of TV or listen to podcasts. There's overlap. There's always overlap. But what I wanted to do is make sure that I got good story out to people who love good story anywhere I could go. You know, so it's not so much about, you know, expanding an empire or some sort of, you know, get rich quick scheme. It's more about, if there are people that love these kinds of stories that will never pick up a podcast, you know, there are certain generations that just won't do that or that are not on a streaming platform for TV, then I need to go where they're at. And so the TV show and the book series allow me to, you know, spread lore around a little bit better and just help the stories go places. It's also really cool when I bump into somebody. This happened on book tour last week where I was in Portland and I'd mentioned a lighthouse story in Portland years ago. And this person remembered me mentioning that story and said, you know, that's a local legend and most people in the world don't even know it, but you took it and turn it into something global and let lots of other people hear it. And it wasn't my goal, you know, it wasn't to let me go find the obscure things and share them with people. But at the same time, there's something really enjoyable about being able to say, here are stories from all over and we can all enjoy them. So that's my goal at the end of the day. Let me just share a story in as many places as I can.
And that's great. I mean, I remember when you announced on the podcast that you were going to be doing this new project, but you reassured people, you're like, don't worry, the podcast is not going anywhere. And I think, yeah. I mean, I was like, oh gosh, I hope that the podcast isn't going anywhere, because it is such an intimate form of storytelling. It is just you kind of just like whispering in someone's ear this really interesting, unique story that they don't hear anywhere else. So I'm glad that you've been able to kind of hold on to both of those worlds.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, the good thing about what I do is that everything starts with writing, and then that's the trunk of the tree. And then all the different media forms are just branches that come off of it. So I record that written form for audio, and that's the podcast. I hand that written thing to the producers and the writers for the TV show, and we adapt it for TV. Or I, you know, put that into a manuscript and I add and I curate for the books. And so everything starts with the one act of writing, and that's pretty satisfying. You know, at the end of the day, I'm a writer. That's what I do.
What scares you?
Oh, I have some of the typical fears that a lot of people have. I don't like open water, which is ironic. I live near the ocean, but I don't like to get past a harbor. It just feels weird. And then the fear of being buried alive, right? That's just that. It's kind of a good mix of everything. It's got fear of the dark, fear of small spaces, and, you know, fear of death.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I know that your father, I don't know how old your children are, but I was wondering if they're grown or, you know, you're not reading stories to them. What kind of stories did you read to them when they were little growing up?
Well, so my kids are little. They're actually not old enough yet to the point where we're letting them experience lore. It's just a little beyond where we feel. And, you know, and that's something that it's interesting. I never set out and said, I'm going to have a filter in my head that limits the content. You know, that you can go find shows on podcast networks that have really deep, you know, fascinations with gore and violence, and you know, that's fine. Some people like that, and they think that that enhances the story. But I wanted to let the story itself, the narrative, be more of the star than the shock.
Well, and as a culture, it seems like we are kind of craving more of these scary horror stories. I mean, around this time of year, of course, but just in general, with things from shows like The Walking Dead to podcasts like Lore, why do you think people enjoy being a little scared?
Well, you know, again, this comes back to me being an armchair psychologist more than anything, but I think part of it just has to do with the emotions you feel when you're afraid are so different than what you feel during your normal day. You know, the rush of adrenaline, you know, the increased heart rate, that little tingle. I think today we live in such a distraction-filled, isolated world, you know, where we're connected to everyone around the globe through social media, but at the same time, we're more alone than we ever were. I think we don't feel as much as we used to. And scary things have a way of bringing the feeling right back. And that might be part of it. Plus, the stuff I talked about earlier, which is with this love of the unknown. You know, we're in a modern world that's kind of chased away all the shadows, you know, with modern medicine and technology. And because you can know everything with a few taps on your phone, there aren't a lot of questions left. And I think that can make people feel like they're a little lost in the sea. And entertaining the shadows is powerful. I think it grounds us a little bit. It's okay to say, I don't know, you know, to hear these stories and say, what in the world was that? Well, I don't know. And I think that for a long time, we've been afraid to say, I don't know, because it sounds weak, but we just don't know sometimes.
And I've heard you say before that people really haven't changed all that much in 300 years. We're still making the same mistakes, still doing the same horrible things and kind of repeating history over and over again. So besides people getting like a little thrill or that feeling of being scared and all the emotions that come up with that, what do you hope people take away when they listen to the podcast or the TV show or read one of the books?
I think it's very frightening how people can use beliefs, fear, and hatred to give themselves permission to do things that are outside the realm of common sense. And it's something that's happened for centuries. It's just kind of taken on different forms as we've gone along. But this idea of the other is what pops up so often in these stories. Sometimes the other is a monster that's been invented by a culture because they need someone to blame for their own mistakes. You know, I've heard it said, some anthropologists think that when the Vikings arrived in Iceland and there was nobody there to conquer, they just had a continent available to them, but they actually invented this idea of the elves because they needed someone to kind of point a finger at and tell stories about. And to this day, 53% of the people in Iceland believe in elves. And I think that there's a little bit of that going on in every generation where we point to the other and we cast our frustrations and blames on them, whether that other is, you know, for a while it was women, for a while it was people of a different skin color or somebody who's outside of our culture, or maybe they're not as religious as us. It's taken on so many different forms. That's the part that I think is the most frightening, is that, you know, we haven't given it up. We just picked a different group of others to focus on, and we still do it in some way, shape, or form.
That's Aaron Mankey speaking with WFAE's Sarah D'Elia in 2017. He's creator, producer, and host of the podcast Lore, which was made into a TV series and is now available on Amazon Prime. He's also the author of the World of Lore book series. And since their conversation originally aired, he's gone on to produce several more podcasts. Learn more at Aaron Mankey, that's MAHNKE.com. The music for the Lore podcast and TV show was composed, incidentally, and performed by local Charlotte musician Chad Lawson. And we'll go out with one of his tracks, appropriately titled, There's Something Up There. Happy Halloween. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.